This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're talking about health insurance, how broken the current system seems to be, and President Obama's attempts to reform it. The hard truth about our country's healthcare system is just about anyone could be one bad diagnosis away from financial ruin. Even if you have a job that comes with insurance, coverage that may seem generous when you're healthy can prove insufficient if you find yourself really sick. These observations come from our first guest, journalist Karen Tumulty. She writes about how the healthcare crisis hit home in the cover story of Time magazine's current edition. As a national political correspondent for Time, she's covered healthcare policy, but she was still unprepared when her brother Pat, who lives in Texas, was diagnosed with kidney failure and learned that his health insurance wasn't going to cover him for it. It was particularly hard for Pat to adjust to the diagnosis, because he has Asperger's syndrome, a disorder which is often described as high-functioning autism. Karen Tumulty, welcome to Fresh Air. What was your brother's problem when he got caught in the whole healthcare system mess?
Well, my brother's problem was something that showed up during a physical that he took in December of 2007. It was showing high concentrations of blood and protein in his urine. That turned out to be very serious kidney disease, which was confirmed and pinpointed the following August in a biopsy.
Now, he had lost his employer-based health insurance when he lost a previous job. What kind of health insurance was he carrying when he got the diagnosis?
Well, it had been 6 years since Pat had had a job that had genuine, you know, employer-provided health benefits. So Pat went out and did what he seemed like the responsible thing at the time. He went out and bought himself on the individual market the best insurance policy that he could afford. And it was a policy that was supposed to be a guarantee against catastrophe. It carried a $2,500 deductible, a 50% copay. So this was not something that he could use for day in and day out health care, but it was there to guard him against a disastrous health event.
Well, he had a disastrous health event. He was diagnosed with kidney disease, and then he was denied coverage. On what grounds?
Well, it turned out that the policy that Pat had bought was, it was a series of policies, all from the same company. He never missed a premium, but he had bought a series of six-month health insurance policies. And what he didn't understand was that each time he renewed that policy every 6 months, it was treated as though he were a brand new customer. And so the reason that his coverage was denied was that the first test results that indicated he could have a problem, even though he was not aware of the implications of those results, had shown up under a previous policy. So the insurance company came back and declared it a pre-existing condition that they were not going to cover.
Even though they were covering him at the time, but it was a different six-month leg. So,
well, that didn't make any sense to me either. So I figured it just had to be some kind of, you know, bureaucratic mix-up or something. Or, you know, okay, if this policy doesn't cover him, well, maybe that old one did. But I found out I was wrong.
And so you know what you're doing. You've covered health insurance. You're a national correspondent for Time. You know how to work the phones, how to talk to people, how to find out information. You did your best to get them to admit that they were wrong and to cover him, and they weren't saying that at all. They were saying, no, he's not covered. And you were making no progress at all. But you finally did, through a lot of investigation, find out something that had happened to a couple of subsidiary companies of this insurance company. Tell us what the insurance regulators in Connecticut found out about this company.
Well, it was after I was well into the research for this story that I discovered that the very same health insurance company had been fined $2 million last year by the Connecticut Insurance Commissioner for doing practices that, to my ear at least, seemed a lot like what my brother had gone through. It was, by the way, the highest fine the insurance commissioner of Connecticut had ever imposed on a company. But what they were doing was in many, many cases, they would go back through people's medical records and find pretexts, essentially, to deny coverage. For instance, there was one woman who developed non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and the insurance company went back through her records and discovered that on a previous visit to the doctor, she had mentioned to her doctor that she was feeling exhausted. And so they said, bang, pre-existing condition. Essentially, she was supposed to have known that feeling tired meant she had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And you saw that with in Connecticut with a number of other cases as well. You know, people who develop multiple sclerosis who should have known that that's what they had. So what happened was after a very long process in Connecticut, the company never did acknowledge any wrongdoing, but they did agree to pay a big fine.
How were you able to use that to help your brother's case in Texas?
Well, what I did was I called the Texas Department of Insurance, and I identified myself as both a journalist and a sister of an aggrieved kidney patient. And I just was asking, you know, how does the law in Texas work? And I was describing this whole situation, and the people from the Texas Department of Insurance, there was a long pause on the other end of the line, and they said, would you do us a favor? Would you file a complaint? So it turned out to be really easy. It took us maybe 10 minutes filling out a form over the internet. And that was in January, and less than a month later, in February, just last month, we got a reply from the insurance company, and they once again said that they had done absolutely nothing wrong, that everything that they did was justified under Texas state law, but that the extraordinary circumstances under this case merited that they would go ahead and pay on his previous claims, because we had subsequently canceled the insurance policy. So what they have agreed to do is go back over the claims from last summer, which, by the way, just to find out what was wrong with my brother, was $14,000 worth of medical bills. So they've agreed to pay their part of that. So far, I believe my brother has received a check for $13.
Okay, so this insurance company said that it was not in the wrong. However, due to the extraordinary circumstances, they were going to pay the 50%. Of the medical costs for the time your brother was insured. I guess I'm wondering if somebody who didn't have the sway that you did would have the same success that you had in getting the insurance company to pay.
Well, I certainly got the attention, I think, of the Texas Department of Insurance, but I do think that, you know, one of my big lessons from all of this is that you've got to complain. At the time when we were hit with this, you know, this $14,000 worth of medical bills and counting that were going to be much, much bigger as he progressed into treatment, I didn't even think to complain because we were so desperate to go out and find him the treatment that he needed. Now I realize that you really do have to go and push, and I do think that people need, if they find themselves in this situation, need to find the regulatory authority that is over it and go right to them.
Does it seem to you like it's part of the way some companies work that they do their best to deny you coverage, and then the way the game is played, you fight to get the coverage, and sometimes they win and sometimes you win, but it's still cheaper for them than paying everything, all the submissions that come their way?
Well, I do think that, you know, insurance companies do not make their money by paying claims. So, I do think that's right. Because my first call after the insurance company decided to deny the benefits and I wasn't getting anywhere was I called my brother's kidney doctor's office. And I got a hold of the woman who runs the billing office there, who's been doing this for 33 years. And she, like me, confidently said, oh, let me, this is ridiculous. Let me take a run at the insurance company. And she called me back within an hour and said, this company is never going to pay you a penny. You should cancel that insurance because the money that your brother is spending on those premiums, he's going to need it for his care.
Now, you learned a lot of things along the way in trying to get health care reimbursement for your brother. One of the things you learned was what you describe as a paradox of medical costs, which is that people who can least afford to pay, the uninsured or the underinsured, end up being charged the most. How did that play out with your brother? Was he charged more than somebody else would be?
Oh, yes, a lot more. See, insurance companies and big programs like Medicare, because they have so many customers, can negotiate with the hospitals and the labs and the doctors and really negotiate down the charges. But for instance, my brother's kidney biopsy, which took place in a hospital last summer, he was charged $7,756 just for the hospital part of it. His insurance company would have been charged $900. So it was, you know, over seven times as much. In a lot of his lab work, he was charged six times as much as an insured patient might have been charged. And one of those lab bills alone was $3,290. And so I think what happens with a lot of uninsured patients is these bills are so huge that they have no choice. They just walk away from them. And that means that the hospitals and the labs and the doctors have to write them off, which means essentially everyone else is paying for those services.
Another paradox that you found along the way was that if your brother got sick enough to need dialysis, the federal government would pick up the costs under the Medicare program for end-stage renal disease. So, in other words, if your brother got so sick that he was on the verge of dying, he'd get coverage through the federal government, but nobody was going to pay to prevent him from getting to the point where he would die and require that coverage.
Oh, and this is, I think, the paradox of healthcare writ large in this country, which is that, you can find help. You can find programs that will pay for really expensive things like dialysis, which is $60,000 a year. But what the system doesn't pay for as much, even for insured patients, is the kinds of stuff that will get you there, preventive care. And, in talking to my brother's primary care doctor in the program that we ultimately got him into, she said, the problem with that is that by the time she sees patients, their conditions are so advanced. You know, they are diabetics whose legs are already numb. They are cancer patients whose disease is already in the advanced stages. And their treatment is much more expensive as a result.
How is your brother now?
My brother is still struggling with the kidney disease, and it does appear to be progressing. When he first saw the doctor last summer, he had something like 48% of kidney function. It's now between 35% and 40%. So he is going to have to move to more aggressive and, I might add, more expensive kinds of treatment, and hopefully to put off dialysis as long as we can.
Does he have insurance now? I don't know who would insure him with such an expensive pre-existing condition.
Oh, boy. We went through so many paths that we went down before we got to treatment. You're right. There is absolutely no way he could now go out and buy a health insurance policy on the open market, given how sick he is. But we were lucky. Pat lives in Bexar County, San Antonio, Texas, which since the 1990s has actually developed through the county hospital system a program that operates much like an HMO for people who make up to 200% of the poverty line, which Pat, with his job, does qualify for. So we have been able to get him coverage under that. But I'm telling you, if he lived just across the county line in Atascosa County or Medina County, that program would not be available to him.
From what you've told us, it seems that in order for your brother to be able to get decent health insurance coverage and to get what he was owed from the company that he did for a while have insurance with, he'd have to really read the fine print in the insurance policy, argue with them effectively, know what the state had to say about health insurance, what his county had to say about health insurance. It's an enormous amount of research to do when you're sick.
You know, it really is. And, you know, and even people who get good health insurance through their employers, I don't think many people have read their health insurance policies. I went back and reread my brother's policy, and, you know, a lot of it is jargon and technical language. And, you know, when a policy says it's non-renewable, I don't think that people understand what the implications of that are if they get sick.
Well, Karen Tumulty, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us, and I wish your brother all the best with his health. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Karen Tumulty is a national political correspondent for Time magazine. She writes about her brother's health insurance problems in the current edition. We just heard one story about facing off with a health insurance company that refused to pay for an illness. To explain why our health insurance system often seems irrational, we invited Uwe Reinhardt, a healthcare economist who is a professor at Princeton. He'll also give us his analysis of President Obama's healthcare plan. Reinhardt is a past president of the Association of Health Services Research and served as a commissioner on the Physician Payment Review Committee established by Congress. Uwe Reinhardt, welcome to Fresh Air. You chaired a commission, and you were appointed by Governor Corzine of New Jersey. So it was a commission to recommend how to make the New Jersey healthcare system more rational.
Correct.
And in one of the chapters of the report, you write about the economics and performance of New Jersey hospitals. And in this chapter, you write about how many different prices there are for the same procedure at one hospital. And New Jersey is typical of other states in this matter. Why are there so many different prices for any one given procedure at a hospital?
Well, every insurer negotiates with every hospital the prices for thousands of different things. And so for a simple procedure like a colonoscopy, one insurer will have 30 different prices, one for each hospital. And then the same hospital might get five different prices from the same insurance company, depending on whether it's an HMO contract, a PPO contract, an indemnity contract, and so on. And I was astounded at the range of prices across the state, just this little state, that some hospitals get maybe $400 for a colonoscopy, and another one might get $3,000 for a colonoscopy. You ask, what drives this? It can't be cost, because they cost pretty much the same. It's just bargaining power. That's all it is.
And then you also write that hospitals attempt to shift costs from one payer to another or from one service line to another based on relative profitability. So I guess one way of counteracting this kind of wacky array of costs is to shift the cost from one payer to another. What do you mean by that?
Hospitals will tell you that Medicaid typically pays less than the full cost of servicing Medicaid patients. Similarly, they claim Medicare pays them maybe 90 cents on the dollar of what it costs to serve Medicare patients. And then they say this shortfall from the government payers, we're going to simply add it to the tab of the commercially insured patients or the self-paying patients. So we raise their prices. That is what they mean by cost shift.
Now, you've also written about how hospitals have really large staffs of billing clerks just to haggle with insurance companies. What kind of haggling goes on between the billing clerks and the insurance companies?
Well, the first thing is there's a haggling over the fee schedules that tie a hospital to an insurer. But then you have a procedure and a patient gets something that may cost $100,000. You submit the claim as a hospital to the insurer. The insurer will now bargain with you and say, was this procedure necessary? And they haggle over the bill. I'm on the board of the Duke University Health System, where our bills often can be in the hundreds of thousands. And so haggling over the bill is profitable, obviously, for the insurer and for Duke. But at Duke, yeah, we combined all the billing departments into one. And at one point, it was 900. We probably streamlined that down maybe to 600, 700 billing clerks. It's a huge operation.
This is just for their healthcare system at Duke?
Yeah, just for the healthcare system and just for the billing. These people push paper. They do not treat patients.
I think sometimes individual doctors have to spend a lot of time haggling, going to bat for their patients who have been denied reimbursement for a procedure that the doctor thinks is essential.
I think that's true, and doctors complain about it. Even in an academic health setting, you still have to fight to get something covered on not needing pre-authorization because there isn't time for it, and so forth. But doctors very often have to be the ombudsman for their patients, arguing with the insurance company. There's no question, and it irritates doctors. The interesting thing is America's doctors are probably the best paid doctors in the world and have a lot of freedom, but they're very unhappy. And one of the unhappiness is this paper pushing and fighting with insurers and so on. It's not a good system. It's actually, in a way, tragic when a nation spends as much on healthcare as we do, that in survey after survey, the American people rate their health system quite low by international standards. I mean, we always rank almost near the bottom in terms of patient satisfaction with the system. And my argument is that isn't over our doctors, who are good, and our hospitals. And I think our healthcare system is actually very customer-friendly. I really don't think it's the delivery system people are complaining about. It's this hassle over how we pay for healthcare. I think how we pay for healthcare makes Americans very unhappy.
Do insurance companies sometimes intentionally withhold a payment and say, oh, no, you're not covered for this procedure, when they know that you are, but they figure if they tell enough people that they're not covered, some of them will just kind of drop it and let it go instead of haggling, and then the insurance company will save money?
Actually, I personally doubt that, because for that to happen, you would have to write this down somehow, because ultimately the people on the front line are fairly poorly paid people who have to implement the policy. So you would have to have that written down somewhere. And such a paper in the hands of a trial lawyer would be just dynamite. So I very much doubt that this is really a formal policy that would happen, or that the insurance companies would even intend to do that. But there are obviously gray areas. When you write an insurance contract with a private insurer, it's called a so-called contingent contract, meaning we will pay you if a certain contingency happens, if you get sick. Now, describing that contingency is very, very difficult. You have to understand these companies have shareholders, and as a management, you're not supposed to throw away shareholders' money. On the other hand, you also have customers, and you obviously do want to serve them and serve them properly. But there are these gray areas where there is a question, was this really insured? To give you an example, there was a case in California where a woman had breast cancer and the doctor wanted to do a bone marrow transplant. The insurance company said, no, this is experimental. We're not covering that. That's not in the contract. And they didn't. Well, the lady died. The company was sued. They had a $90 million settlement. But some years later, research did establish that bone marrow transplants don't work in this instance. And what the company did was actually defensible. So there are these gray areas. Yet it might also have come out the other way, that the research years later showed this really did work, and then you make the company look like they were evil. People have to understand that it's extremely difficult to write an insurance company with a private and commercial insurer. It's different when you deal with a government. They'll either pay it or they won't, like in Canada.
Well, as President Obama tries to rewrite some of America's healthcare policy and how we pay for healthcare, you say that Americans are really suffering from cognitive dissonance about healthcare, that they distrust government and they don't want government running the healthcare system, and they supposedly have faith in markets, but you say they're unwilling to accept the harsh verdicts of the market in healthcare, like when you're denied payment to reimburse you for a procedure. Talk a little bit more about this cognitive dissonance that you think we suffer from in America.
Cognitive dissonance, of course, means that you hold two different theories that are in conflict with one another, but they're both in your brain and in your soul. That's what this means. Now, for example, you will have Americans say, the government doesn't have the right to tell me to buy health insurance. But the same Americans will say, if I get hit by a truck and I lie bleeding in the street, society owes it to me to send an ambulance, and the emergency room doctors owe it to me to save my life. How could both be true? Even a teenager would blush at something this ridiculous. If you believe society has a duty to save your life when you get hurt, you have a duty to chip into a fund that pays for that.
The things that you describe as irrational in America's current healthcare system, Can you find these problems in other developed countries?
No, I don't think so. The typical Canadian or German or Englishman understands that they have to pay taxes or premiums to be insured, because you're all in this together, because you also expect society to save your life when you get in trouble, and they understand tit for tat. I remember my own mother giving me a lecture once when she had to wait in Germany 2 weeks for the neighboring hospital to have a bed, and I said, oh, I can make a phone call and get you in earlier, and she said, I was asocial. She says, then some other lady has to step back. How could this be decent? So here I felt lectured by my mother, who had this sense of social solidarity that, yes, we have a good health system, but you also have to sometimes wait or step back to keep this affordable. Americans complain about the cost of their health care, but they have the desire, I want everything my doctor prescribes, whether it's appropriate or not, and I want it today. And then they go and look at God and complain about healthcare costs. This is extremely frustrating.
If you're just joining us, my guest is healthcare economist Uwe Reinhardt. He's a professor of economics at Princeton University, and he's written extensively about the economics of healthcare. President Obama is trying to reform healthcare in the United States. He says his principles are: coverage should be universal, affordable, portable, and there should be investments in prevention and improved quality of care. So those are his principles, but he says he's going to let Congress write the details of what the system will look like. And I'm wondering if you think there are inherent problems with letting politicians write healthcare policy when it comes down to the type of policy determining how insurance will work.
No, I think that's a smart approach. We had the alternative. The Clintons tried it, where you had a whole bunch of wonks, 1,000 policy people tucked away somewhere in Washington, developing a finished plan where absolutely everything was determined by the White House, presenting it to the Congress and saying, please pass this plan. And the Congress laughed and tore it up and threw it in the garbage can. And that was that. And the lesson we learned from that is, since the politicians have to vote on this and appropriate the money, they must have considerable say on how this looks. So the Obama people are extremely smart, laying out the principles and then letting the Congress spec this out. Now, on the Hill, you can't have 535 people write this, obviously. You have leaders. Max Baucus, Senator Baucus, took the leadership last summer. He has an exquisite staff of people. They wrote a white paper, and the white paper lays out a passable health reform plan. It's very similar to Obama's plan, by the way, but you could take that and start with it and then make amendments as other players, Senator Kennedy, Senator Orrin Hatch. There are people in Congress, in the Senate and the House, who have specialized in health care. In the House, it would be Congressman Pete Stark, for example. These are really experts. And they together, I think, could fashion a bill that obeys roughly the principle of President Obama, but is passable and fundable and so on. So I think that is the approach that should be taken. And fortunately, Senator Baucus has already done most of the homework for that.
So what do you think about the basic principles of Obama's plan?
Well, the basic principles are sound, and I think they would be shared. I think they'd be shared by Senator McCain. Everyone wants universal coverage, wants health care to be efficient and affordable, wants preventive care. I don't think Senator McCain would have differed on those broad principles. But if you go to the campaign website of then-Senator Obama, he was really quite specific in detail of how that thing should look. For example, he had proposed a Medicare-like plan for people under 65. Now, in Medicare, it's government-run, it's permanent, it's portable, and so on. And Senator Obama said, I want younger people to have the same right to have a plan that is portable, that's permanent, it's government-run, somebody they trust. That will be, of course, extremely controversial to the private insurance industry, because their fear that they cannot compete was a public plan, that Americans would gravitate more and more into it, and eventually the private insurance industry would die out. So the big battleground in the forthcoming health reform debate will be this idea of having a public plan. And my gut tells me that maybe President Obama will possibly give up on that idea if, in return, the insurance industry comes to the bargaining table and gives him what he wants, which is that any insurer must serve everyone who comes to them, and the premiums cannot reflect the health status of the individual applicant for insurance. So there's going to be some fierce horse trading this summer over this, and my gut tells me the public plan may very well become a victim of it.
And that in return we would get, you could get health care in spite of any pre-existing condition. That would be irrelevant.
Yeah, but that only works if you mandate insurance. See, if I have, we have in New Jersey, for example, what is called pre-existing conditions, this guaranteed issue. If you go to an insurance company, they have to take you, and they must charge all their customers the same rate, whether they're sick or healthy. Where when you have on top of that, that health insurance is voluntary, then healthy people will not insure and take a chance. And when they get sick, they have the right to join a pool without having taken their sickness into account. That system will inexorably lead to the death of the insurance plan. And in New Jersey, it is happening. The private commercial insurance for individuals is so expensive that most people don't take it. So Obama then would have to go and say, okay, like Massachusetts, you must be insured. It's mandatory. And that's what the private insurance industry is saying. If you want what is called community rate, everyone the same premium, then you have to mandate health insurance or this cannot work. And the insurance industry is right on that one. So there's much to do at the bargaining table this summer.
Do you think that the nature of support for health insurance reform has changed since the Hillary Clinton initiative of the 90s?
Yes, I think in the 90s when Hillary Clinton came, things were actually still pretty good. And you had the AMA basically opposed to it, the National Association of Manufacturers. They thought they could handle it on their own. The private insurance industry was pretty rambunctious with the Harry and Louise ads. So they all thought if the Clintons just went away, everything would be fine and they could handle it. No one thinks that now. The private insurance industry knows that it is actually a declining industry unless they get this new book of business from government. So they are not opposed. The hospitals and the physicians are desperate with patients that they serve who cannot pay them because either their deductibles are very high or they don't have insurance. So it's really beginning to hurt the hospital and the physicians. So they are on board. The average American citizen, even if you have a job today and you have health insurance, you are thinking you might not have it tomorrow or next year. And that wasn't true in the 90s. People sort of felt secure. So the whole landscape has changed.
If the new healthcare system mandated that everybody had to carry health insurance, what kind of prices are we talking about here? I mean, I know the health care that you get through your job is usually pretty expensive. A lot of people, who, particularly people who weren't employed, couldn't afford to pay that. So how, if it's mandated, would people afford to cover themselves?
Oh, yes. And Senator Obama and now President Obama had been very explicit to say there will have to be substantial subsidies to help lower-income people buy this product. And as you know in his speech the other day, he said he'll earmark particular sources of funds, $634 billion, for the next 10 years to provide these subsidies to low-income people. Now, if you divide it by 10, that's about $65 billion a year, and or $63 billion a year. And he had, in the campaign, said he would roughly think of $65 billion a year. So one could say he's owning up to the campaign promise, with those funds. Whether he'll get them is another issue that depends, of course, on the Congress. But in any event, I do believe he's making a very sincere effort to own up to a promise that he made. My hunch is to get full insurance coverage for everyone in America, the total amount of money the federal government would have to think about is probably more like $120 billion a year today, say, or maybe for next year, so double what he would spend. But he never did promise that he'll go to 100% insurance coverage, as Senator Clinton had promised. He never did promise that. He said, we'll make a substantial down payment, and sort of covering half would, in my view, be an honorable gesture on this promise. So I think one can be hopeful that something substantial will happen. My own feeling on this would be the easy way to make sure if you are reasonable would be to have a debate on the following simple question. What percent of a family's discretionary income, that is income after housing and food and clothing, discretionary income, what percent of that should a family be expected to pay for its own health care? If you look at upper income people, like professors at Ivy League colleges, you could say, well, that should be 15%. Your income is such that we could expect you to eat at least 15% of your discretionary income. If you look at a waitress, you might say, you know, for her or him, that couldn't be more than 5% because the income is so low. But can you see if we had a debate on what is it that one can reasonably ask fellow Americans to pay for their own health care, you could get somewhere. And I would hope President Obama would steer the debate into something that people can understand, like this particular question.
If you're just joining us, my guest is healthcare economist Uwe Reinhardt. He's a professor of economics at Princeton University, and he's written extensively about the economics of healthcare. Do you think if we pass healthcare reform and the insurance is all in the hand of private insurance, or even if it's a combination of private insurers and government insurance, that there will still be a class system in terms of the quality of health care that you get depending on the money that you're willing to pay for the insurance plan that you buy?
I think it'll happen, although this is not really what Americans in general would like. But it could happen in the following sense, that you will get subsidies from the government that help you buy a low-cost insurance product. But that insurance product will cover only generic drugs. And it'll cover only certain hospitals that are low cost. And if you want to go to another hospital, they might tell you, well, we'll pay you what we would have paid for the cheap hospital, but if you want to go to Columbia Presbyterian, for example, you pay the whole difference out of pocket yourself. This is called reference pricing, where the insurer pays for a standard model, but if you want something more superior, you pay the difference out of pocket. I could see that come as the American solution to creating a class-based health system, because you could say, well, we give you something, but if you want sort of the superior model, you have to pay it out of pocket. That would be rationing by income class. My hunch is, at some point, that's what we'll do in this country. But if any politician proposed that now, it would still be politically incorrect.
Do you think that the direction we're headed in will keep our country as an employer-based insurance system for the most part?
I think some of the larger companies will always prefer to offer health insurance on the job because it's a good come-on in the labor market. And let's not forget, we now have great unemployment, but the labor force in America is shrinking relative to the number of elderly and children. So we will have a labor shortage in the next few years, not in the next 3-4 years, but in the next decades. And offering health insurance is a good come-on in the labor market. The problem with the American approach is you're losing that coverage just when you need it most, which is when you become unemployed and you don't have any income, and you also lose your health insurance. That is a very devilish system. That doesn't happen in Canada. If GM in Canada were to close, the workers would not lose their health insurance. They would lose their income, but not their health insurance. And in America, you lose your job and your income. On top of it, you lose your health insurance. There is no health policy analyst who would ever put in place such a system if we could do it all over again. It's an accident of World War II that we have it.
Now, you know your way around healthcare policy, that's for sure. And you know a lot about healthcare economics. What's a typical problem you've faced with getting your health care covered? Do you have to fight for things that you think should be insured and then you're told they're not?
No. Fortunately, that really hasn't happened. This complexity of claiming for health insurance is so awesome that my wife does it. This goes beyond the capacity of a PhD in economics. So she does it, and she tells me the claiming for health insurance is far more time-intensive and complex than the income tax, which she also does. So she deals with this, because my attitude always is, oh, geez, I'm so busy. Why don't we just pay it and not argue? But she will argue, because she says it's wrong.
See, that's where they get you, though, right? Like, because they know some people are just not going to take the time.
Slobs like me, yeah, they won't take the time. Now, if it were a really big bill, I'm sure but she fights even for smaller things if she thinks it's just wrong. Where, you know, a guy like me would say, I know it's wrong, but my time is too busy. I'll just eat it. And I think the insurance industry very often just relies on people like me and say, we'll just eat it. But fortunately, we've not been so sick that it's ever been an issue. And then if you work at a class employer like Princeton, professors really have it good. I mean, we don't share the American experience, frankly, given we have tenure and given we, particularly Ivy League, we have good health insurance. In some way, I personally don't share the agony of the American people. On the other hand, I grew up in a tool shed, and I know how good it was that when we were paupers, my family, we had health insurance like everyone else in Germany. I've never forgotten that, and I would like the American people to have what I had and my mother had as a kid. So that is why I care. For me personally, I'm fine.
Any final thoughts you want to leave us with about the state of the current healthcare system or what changes you'd like to see made?
Well, I would tell listeners, stay away from people who try to solve the healthcare debate with cliches like, oh, this is socialized medicine, and then you don't have to think anymore. Try to actually think through the issues and say, what is your predicament? What kind of country would you want to live in? Do you want to live in a country where someone who loses their job loses their health insurance? Is that what you want? Do you want a system where kids come out of college and for the next 10 years they can't get insurance? You want people who have family members struck with cancer to lose their house or their car? I mean, ask yourself, what kind of country do you want to live in? And all of these things I mentioned, we have now. You lose your insurance with your job. You can lose your house and go bankrupt over a health care bill. No Canadians or Germans ever go bankrupt over medical bills. Why should we in America do that? And get away from the cliches. And really, this is, my fellow Americans, this really is your last chance. If you don't get health insurance solved this year or the next year, you're in for some really deep trouble.
Why now or never?
Because you have a president who really is committed to this, and it requires presidential leadership. You also have a Congress whose leaders in healthcare are really committed to this idea. And we're in a calamity. We're in possibly a depression. We don't know, but it could happen. It's sort of everything comes together, and it's a unique opportunity to get this done. We do know that in better times, every time we tried it, the demagogues won. Harry and Louise won. And this time, Harry and Louise should not win. You shouldn't even listen to them.
And you're referring to the two characters on a commercial back in the 90s opposing the Clinton reform plan.
Yeah. And I think there's a group now gearing up. And I hope that when they oppose whatever President Obama wants to do, they will actually reason with it. One can disagree honorably over many things in health policy, but don't use cliches like socialized insurance. The fact is that for the bottom half of the income distribution in America, social health insurance is the only solution.
Uwe Reinhardt, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, and very good questions. Thank you, Terry.
Uwe Reinhardt is a professor of political economy at Princeton University. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.